The first Sunday morning service to be celebrated in this sanctuary was held 50 years ago on the 24th of October of 1924. The last Sunday morning service, at least for the time being, which will be celebrated here, will take place next week, when in honor of Mother's Day, the women from the Temple Women's Association will occupy the pulpit. In these last 50 years, this sanctuary has seen many a noble service. 1,650, to be exact, and the aggregate congregation has numbered over 1,250,000 people. Now, how do I know this? Well, beginning in 1924, Sir Joseph Guggenheim, who was then the senior usher of the temple, and for the next began to compile and to maintain a register of every service, all the basic facts, and he was to maintain this register for 35 years. And since his death, it has been maintained and kept up to date by Jim Rich. And this register provides us with the date, the kind of weather, the speaker, the subject, the names of any visiting groups who happen to be in the temple that day, and any other information that was deemed to be pertinent. It's a fascinating record, and it provides probably the most complete chronicle of any worship in any pulpit in America, certainly in Jewish America, over that period of time. This is an amazingly disciplined pulpit in the sense of the records that we've kept. We know not only when and where and who and what, but what music was played. We've only to look back in the old records of the temple bulletin. We know what was said. For the last 18 years, a tape script has been kept of every lecture, turned into a recording, a record which is available in the temple library and is often consulted and taken out and used by shut-ins and those who want to hear what one of us said about a particular subject. And before we began to tape these lectures, a manuscript was kept of them, obviously the preparation, but more than that, a stenographic record was kept of actually what was said. A legal secretary sat in the balcony of the temple week in and week out and took down a verbatim transcript of what was said. I don't know quite why Mr. Guggenheim began this long chronicle of these services, the numbers and the like, but I do know why this transcript was kept. You remember that after the First World War, there was a Red Scare, not unlike the McCarthy period at the end of the Second World War. There were the Palmer raids. There was all the confusion around the Sacco-Vanzetti trial, and there were all kinds of attempts made to suppress opinions which were then deemed to be radical or liberal. A a record would begin to be kept in by the national agencies, the security agencies, of those who seemed to be speaking about un-American themes such as the closed shop, or the fact that it might be best for the United States to join the League of Nations rather than to remain on the outside. There was in Cleveland during those years a vigilante committee of seven self-appointed patriots who made it their business to try and censor the liberal pulpits and whatever there was of a liberal press by passing rumors and suggestions of un-American messages being delivered. And when men began to appear here on a Sunday morning and to take notes on what Dr. Silver was saying, he was very proud of what he was saying and wanted his voice to be clearly heard, also wanted to be heard accurately. And in order that every pronouncement, every lecture might be understood properly, he began in defense of his position to have this stenographic typescript made. And so we have a remarkable record of a 50-year experience. It's one which allows me to tell you that on October 24th, 1924, at the first of these Sunday morning services here in what was then the New Temple, there were 2,015 people in attendance. It was a bright, sunshine-filled October day. Rabbi Silver spoke on the theme, Organized Religion, World Peace. These were the years in which the United States was pulling back from its international involvements, the Wilson period. The issue was whether or not we ought to join the World Court. We'd already decided not to join the League of Nations. And that particular morning, Dr. Silver addressed himself to the position of the church, the churches of America, who talk so much of peace, but who, when it comes down to a hard battle, such as the battle to join the World Court, are so often simply not there, on the grounds that the church's concerns are spiritual, and the political concerns are best left to politicians. God save us. That particular day, he began by suggesting that he spoke of the church rather than the synagogue, largely because the synagogue lacked the numbers, the power here in America to be effective in an issue such as this. And I'd like to read to you a few paragraphs of that first lecture, because in many ways it speaks still to themes which are still current, certainly themes which were of significance and relevance during this long last decade where Vietnam and all the attended issues were of primary concern. He said then, the church must decide whether it means to vindicate its historic claim to be the peacemaker of the world and aggressively to lead mankind along the hard road to peace. Whether it will be as heretofore, more cautious than courageous, more shrewd than wise, and refuse to enter the arena of struggle, and content itself with a mechanical repetition of its age-old exhortations to peace and goodwill. In the past, the church alienated the loyalty and devotion of millions of men because of its refusal to participate in the economic and industrial adjustments made necessary by the new conditions of life. Thinking men and women must ultimately turn from an institution whose inspiration is solely of the past and in the past, and whose will is atrophied, an institution to which men cannot turn for guidance and inspiration in the troubling and harassing emergencies of their social existence. It is my firm conviction that the church will assume leadership in the work of establishing international peace only when it will transcend the state. In many countries, the church is either an outright state church or receives its subvention from the state. Even in democracies where the church does not receive financial support from the state, it has so completely yielded itself up to the political philosophy of the state that it is content in most instances to underwrite the policies and programs of that state. If a state declares war, the church will sanction it or condone it. If the state engages in imperialistic expansion and exploitation, the church will either endorse the act or, in pusillanimous worldliness, remain silent. As long as the church does not rise above the state, not in the sense of endeavoring to master it or to control its political fortunes, but in the sense of freeing itself from an alignment which carries with it the endorsement of its political purposes and programs, so long will peace, the traditional and avowed ideal of the church, remain an abstraction. During the last war, every church became a state church. The Christian church in Germany was German first and only secondarily, and by a wide stretch of the imagination, Christian. And that was true of almost all churches in Christendom and all synagogues of Jewry. Now, religion is international in the finest and truest sense of that word. It is not opposed to nationalism, it overleaps it. It does not concern itself with nationalism, it concerns itself not with the temporary political units of men, but with man himself and with mankind. It goes beyond race and creed and governmental boundaries. Its domain is the world of common human needs and aspirations, of justice and peace and holiness. Its empire is of the universal spirit. When religion speaks of these basic things, its voice is listened to and men obey. But when it loses its prophetic voice and becomes an echo of the state, of ingrown nationalism and of racialism, it ceases to be a force in the work of human rehabilitation. The church must be the guide, the critic, and the censor of the state, not its tool or its propaganda channel. It will be in a position to create a real temperament for peace, a peaceful frame of mind, a will for peace. Peace is not altogether a question of economics. If religion can free itself from the shackles which in the past have tied it to the organism we call the state, if religion can be itself again, independent, true to its own inspiring mission, speaking fearlessly and passionately, it can set about kindling the imagination of mankind with the ideal of peace. Whenever a state will declare a defense day, organized religion should declare a peace day. Whenever a state will declare a navy day, organized religion should declare a world court day. It is not enough to cry peace, peace, when there is no peace. The church must call the attention of men to the agencies, however provisional, however rudimentary, which promise to bring peace if only one step nearer. And on and on. Now, this kind of concern with the immediate problems of the day, try and attempt to understand the role of religion in the public life as in the private life of our times, as characterized this pulpit. It's only to read the record of the last 50 years to know that. Dr. Silver spoke in this vein on all the subjects of the time nearly 1,000 times from this pulpit. And this is now the 349th lecture that it has been my privilege to give. And that's a lot of preparation. I could very easily list for you the long record of distinguished people who have occupied the pulpit. But I'll content myself with telling you one interesting fact I discovered as I reviewed the ledger, and that is that the first woman to occupy this pulpit was the Secretary of Labor in President Roosevelt's administration, the Honorable Frances Perkins. Now, this service, next week, will not be the last in the temple's program of Sunday morning worship. It'll be continued at the branch next fall. And that first Sunday in October of 1924 was not the first Sunday of a worship such as this in the temple's history. The temple's history of a Sunday morning fall to spring cycle of worship lectures goes back to 1886, when it was inaugurated by the then rabbi of the temple, Aaron Hahn. Rabbi Hahn was a very scholarly man. He had not only been ordained as a rabbi, but he had received his doctorate in philosophy from Leipzig University before he came to this pulpit. And he was concerned that Judaism be an expression of the needs of the time, judgmental, intelligent, relevant, creative, as well as simply a repetition of the tradition, however warming and encouraging that tradition might be. He was not satisfied with ethnic nostalgia, nor with simple enthusiasm. Judaism, he felt, was a deep and profound faith, which had learned many things, mostly subtle things, over its long history. That he wanted an opportunity when men were fresh and awake, newly awake, to deal with them. And he created in 1886 this pattern of congregational worship, which we have continued ever since. Now, we're familiar with it. We take it for granted. We know its beauty. But those who come from other traditions within Judaism or from other cities often wonder, you know, why we have moved the Sabbath to Sunday. What kind of goyish thing is this? And the answer, of course, is that we never moved the Sabbath to Sunday. In all of its years, we've always used the weekday service of the Union Prayer Book or of its predecessors. Jews worshiped every day. We did not bring the rich ceremony of the Sabbath onto Sunday. And during all of the last 50 years, the temple has had a Sabbath morning service as well as this service. What we did do, what Dr. Hahn did do, was to try to take advantage of an opportunity and to respond to the reality of his time. And that, of course, was and remains the basic benchmark of any reform. It's well to remember that in 1886, America had not yet entered the leisure society. The working man worked 6 days a week, 12 hours a day. Those who owned operated stores were open 12, 14 hours a week or more, 6 days a week. The professional man, the doctor, the dentist, the lawyer worked 6 days a week. These were not yet the affluent era that we've had over the last 20 or 30 years. And in America, the Sabbath morning worship, which is the traditional worship, the full worship, the warmest, most beautiful, richest worship of our tradition, was very difficult to maintain. Only the women could come, and then not always. The men were simply not available. Many of the women worked in those days, not in exalted jobs, but in menial tasks to keep the family together. And so the rabbis, all of them, and the congregations, all of them, were looking for opportunities to allow the congregation to come together, to have some sense of its numbers, to have a chance for congregational meeting and worship. And the pattern developed at about the same time in a number of congregations of having a lecture weekday service on Sunday morning. And that was the pattern that Dr. Hahn adopted. Sunday morning was a very different time than it is now. Men and women worked then 6 days a week, but on the seventh day, everyone rested by law. There were all kinds of blue laws in effect. And this was the time when Americans went to worship, not to the golf course, not to the tennis club. They didn't stay home in bed, they went to worship. This was the pattern in America at the time. Taking advantage of this envelope, this cultural envelope, taking advantage of the fact that there was very little else one could do on the morning of Sunday, this seemed to be an ideal time to reform, to have a reform kind of experience, that is, a new experience. And they began to experiment with this kind of lecture service. About a generation later, the congregations which developed after the first congregations in the major cities saw this major meeting of people on a Sunday morning and immediately jumped to the conclusion that this was the Sabbath. And they too, they ticked it off as something which was not traditionally Jewish. They wanted something which was more Jewish, and so they created something which in its own way was less Jewish, a late Friday evening service. The late Friday evening service is a reform. Jewish worship traditionally is daytime worship. The Jew worshipped in the morning, Shacharit. He worshipped in the early afternoon, Mincha. And he worshipped just before sunset, Ma'ariv. With the exception of Yom Kippur, which is a 24-hour vigil of worship, there is no required evening worship in our tradition. Only the Kabbalists had at midnight a special mystical service they called Tikkun Chatzot, and it was only for the enlightened, for the very special few. The idea of a late Friday evening or late evening service of any kind ran counter to a long tradition among our people, which held that worship ought not to be shadowed in the darkness when men were tired and when women were tired, but at daytime when they were alert and alive. There was always to be an intellectual content to our worship, not simply emotion. Or to translate that into the visible and the what we recognize all about, after one has worked the long day and eaten a large meal called the Sabbath meal and runs to the synagogue for participation in Sabbath worship, you're tired, tired of mind, body's busy digesting the meal. You have had no chance to digest quietly by yourself. And the service can have beauty. It can have some singing, but it must be short. And the message that must be brought must be simple. It must encourage, but it cannot deal with subtleties, with nuances. There's no time for it. And I see this more than most again and again. Because since we don't have the late Friday evening pattern here, I often am invited here, there, Cleveland and out, to give the sermon of a Friday night. And very often I'm tempted to bring them a lecture I've presented here, something I've worked on and of concern to me. And inevitably when I make that mistake, I find that after 15 minutes, they can't follow. You can't listen any longer. That you have to deal with simplicities. And this rabbi abhors simplicities. That you have to deal with enthusiasms. And enthusiasms are very dangerous. Now, the late Friday evening service became the pattern. And after the Second World War, many of the old established congregations reverted or changed to this other reform. It allowed them to read from the Torah regularly. It allowed them to have a kiddush and a candle lighting, some of the ritual, which people obviously wanted. But they paid a price. They paid a price in terms of the Torah side of public worship. Its need to enlighten. Its need to teach. Its need to be something more than a rather simplistic moment of spiritual encouragement. So we have not made the change. We do not really intend to make the change. For over this long, nearly 90-year history of this Sunday morning lecture worship series, we've tried to remain loyal to its basic purpose, which is to present beautiful worship, lovely surroundings, with meaningful liturgy, but also to use it as part of the educational mission of any congregation. Judaism cannot simply be a formalistic repetition of the past. It cannot be simply the lighting of candles, the blessing of wine. It is nothing if it doesn't have a message for the time, if it does not cut into the personal, the family, the political problems of the day. And to do so with any honesty requires your intelligence and mine, requires alertness in the morning. Now, obviously, what we do here is not necessarily what must be done. The service which was conducted 50 years ago had a great deal of that sense of dignity and discipline, which was so important to Jews who are just a generation or two out of the European experience, who came into a world where the Protestant church was a place of silence and quiet, who remember the noisiness of the synagogue, the moving about, the conversations, the babble, the talking on the steps outside during the long service, and who had been scandalized by it from their new perspective. They wanted quiet. They wanted beauty. They wanted the magnificence of these surroundings. They wanted music which came at them with its full beauty, where they didn't have to be preoccupied with the posturings of a cantor. And over these last 50 years, we have, I think, sculpted a service of great beauty. But we have changed. We're not the same people who thronged here in 1924. We don't want simply to sit quietly with our thoughts in our pews. We want to sing. We want a sense of congregation. We want a sense of warmth. This is a participant generation. It's one of its key words. A major purpose of our move to the branch next fall is to try and create there a different envelope for the liturgy, a different sense, a different feel to the worship. We're not so much overawed by the sense of height. We're not so spread out, but have come together almost to touch, where we can feel the congregation, where we can sing the service rather than it's being sung at us, where we can participate more fully in the liturgy, when we be part of, partners in, essential to the worship element in this worship. Now, to understand what has been and what will be, we need to look also down one of the other columns in Mr. Guggenheim's register, and that is the attendance column. And it presents a fascinating bit of history. We discover that in every decade, every one of the five decades, attendance at these services has dropped by 20%. In the 1920s, there were never less than 40,000 people here at the 31 or 32 services that were conducted during this season. In the 1930s, there were never 40,000 people here in the course of the year. The numbers ran between 30 and 40,000. In the 1940s, the aggregate never reached 30,000. The numbers ran between 20 and 30,000. In the 1950s, the numbers never reached 20,000. They ran between 12 and 17,000. In the 1960s, They never touched 12,000. They ran between 8 and 12,000. And in the 1970s, we have been running between 6 and 8,000 people at about the same number of services a year. Now, the fascinating things about the fact of these statistics is they have almost nothing to do with the person in the pulpit. This congregation, for four-fifths of this time, had one of the premier rabbis and orators in America constantly in the pulpit, and his career was ever in the ascendancy. He was becoming better and better known. And yet, as he was becoming better and better known, that pattern of the 20% decline was very evident, there, measurable. How shall we explain it, and what does it say? One explanation might be that the service itself is inappropriate, perhaps. But when we consult such figures as exist for congregations which took the path of the late Friday evening service, we find a similar decline in attendance figures. Piety, in the sense of the discipline of public worship, has eroded at about a 20% rate in all liberal congregations across these United States. And the only place where you see a sense of enthusiasm for public worship is in the new congregations, and for a very brief period. When they first come together, when everyone feels a sense of responsibility. And then for perhaps 10 years, you have a sizable percentage of the congregation at worship. And then this seemingly inevitable decline sets in. And the decline is steep. In the 1920s, over 1,500 people attended these worship services every single Sunday. In the 1970s, around 200 people attended worship every Sunday. In the 1920s, this congregation was half the size that it is today. The statistics cannot be blinked away. What do they say? They say something about the envelope of religion in the United States, the attitude that the average American has towards God, towards faith. In the average church, there's been a decline in worship, not in any way as steep as it has been in the synagogue. But wherever you turn, we have moved towards a more secular society, which is to say that during this 50-year period, Americans have been more and more confident of themselves and less confident of God. More and more confident that they can do it alone, less and less in need of divine inspiration, or less and less desirous of the oughts, the duties, that the traditional religious teachings, the commandments, set before us. But obviously there's more to it than that. It says something about the changing nature of a Jewish congregation. Certainly one of the roles that this kind of worship service played in the 1890s, 1910, 1920s, was as part of the Americanization process of the congregation itself. The rabbi was to a certain degree the interpreter of the new ethos of freedom, democracy, justice under law, which the immigrants did not completely understand. He helped people to clarify their minds. Your minds are now fully clear. The service itself had other purposes, other factors to it. We've come through a period in which the traditional ties, whether the tie of the religious community, or the tie of the family, or the tie of personal moral values, has tended to loosen, an era of liberation, an era where people have moved away from institutions generally to do it on their own, to make their own way and to find their own truth. No one wanted the truth laid out for them. And obviously this too is part of the tradition. But when all is said and done, we face a paradox. And the paradox is that this congregation, its members, are probably more involved in Jewish life today than they were in the 1920s, and less involved in Judaism, in the religion, than they were in 1920s. The Jewish community of Cleveland is terribly involved in the United Jewish Appeal and the Jewish agencies and the concerns of Israel, Soviet anti-Semitism, the Iraqi Jews, all of these human concerns. There is more activity which is particularly and specially Jewish activity by more members of this temple, I'm sure, in 1974 than in 1924. But at the same time, the ties which bind families, individuals, to public worship, or to the rituals of a tradition, these have been minimized, slackened off. They're less evident. By matter of coincidence, the very same bulletin which announced the first Sunday morning service here held here in 1924 also had an article which began this way: "The temple will inaugurate a Friday Vesper service." At the same time that the congregation moved into this new building and began here its pattern of Sunday morning worship, they began the pattern of the 5:30 Vesper service, which we have continued to this day. And interestingly, the attendance figures at that service, though they have not been as carefully kept, clearly indicate that the service continues to hold its own, 100, 120, 140 people in attendance, as it did very much at the beginning. Over 50 years it's held its own. But notice what's happened. When they inaugurated that service, this is what they said: "The announcement made from the pulpit last Monday that beginning Friday, November 7th, a Vesper service of prayer and song to usher in the Sabbath will be inaugurated has been universally greeted." The Monday they're referring to was the inaugural activity here at the temple. "The service will be held throughout the year on Fridays from 5:30 to 6:10 p.m. It will afford an opportunity to entire families, parents and children, to join in worship. Men on their way home from business will be able to meet their families at the temple, together join in a quiet and restful period of devotion and prayer." Obviously, the hope was that the traditional Sabbath might be recreated, relived, by the membership of this congregation. The families would meet here. Most of the men still work downtown. Most of the families were relatively in this area. The family would meet here and have a Kabbalat Shabbat service, a service to welcome the Sabbath. And then everyone would go home, and there'd be the Sabbath table, the Kiddush, hopefully some songs, and the family would stay together at home on Friday night. The Sabbath would be observed in family. That's the traditional Sabbath. It's a family occasion. Now, what did that service quickly become, and what has it been remained? It became a Yahrzeit service. Those who come are those who have Kaddish to say. It's a service of memory. And what has happened to the traditions of Jewish life is that by and large they depend upon two phenomena: the sense of our desire to memorialize, to participate in the rites of memory and remembrance, Yizkor, Yahrzeit, and nostalgia. What the fiddler sang about when he talked of tradition, tradition. Jews have not wanted to hear clearly oughts, the obligations, that which comes through preaching, teaching. By and large, they have not wanted really to be enlightened about the traditional perspectives of their faith. It was easier to assume that their faith taught what they already assumed to be true. And wherever you touch, here, any other city, what you discover is a pattern of life which has tried to reduce the synagogue to a place of nostalgia, to a place for the occasional experience of tradition, I'll come when I need it, when I want it, but I don't want it really to grip me. I don't want it to shatter, to challenge some of the certainty, some of the assumptions that I've made about my life. That's not wanted. And so our synagogues have more and more been under pressure to produce services without sermons, to produce moments of ethnic nostalgia, which have no Torah, to be places of candle lighting and wine blessing and an occasional folk song, but without the heart, without the guts, without the teachings of the tradition. And dear friends, that's precisely why we are continuing the practice of Sunday morning worship here at the temple. For whatever the attendance be, this congregation is determined to maintain its responsibility as guide, goad, and teacher. The pulpit has a 2,000-year history in our tradition. Teaching is elemental, basic to our tradition. If Judaism ever becomes satisfied simply to do what has been done, to participate in a few easy rites, it has no reason to continue. For it is then simply something which is a colorful add-on to our lives. If it cannot reach us and challenge us and hopefully change us, it's an exercise in futility. And though we will change the feel of the service to fit the needs, the emotional needs of those of us who will live today, the purpose of the service and the basic purpose of the synagogue does not change. We must be true to what we are, regardless. And I have a strange suspicion that in the 50 years that lie ahead, which will not be affluent years, nor expansionist years, nor imperialist years for our nation, which will be years of shortages, years of scarcity, years in which many of us will have to learn to do with less, falling standards of living, years in which men will no longer be as confident of their being gods, able to solve on their own all of the problems which face them. But more and more people, particularly the young people, will respect a religious institution which is true to its last, which continues as honestly as it can to confront the problems of the day with the wisdom of the past as understood through the minds of the present, which continues to teach as well as to provide moments of memory, moments of memorial, moments of warmth, and moments of beauty. To paraphrase a paragraph from Dr. Silver's first sermon here, in the past, the synagogue alienated the loyalty and devotions of millions of men because of its refusal to participate in the intellectual, political adjustments made necessary by the new conditions of life. Thinking men and women must ultimately turn from an institution whose inspiration is solely of the past and in the past, and whose will is atrophied. An institution to which men cannot turn for guidance and inspiration in the troubling and harassing emergencies of their social existence. It is to an institution whose inspiration is of the past, but whose purpose is in the present, that this worship has been dedicated, God willing, will continue to be devoted. Amen.